Welcome to the Business Radio Network. Enjoy Small Biz, Big Voices with Stephanie Rising.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Rising, a business coach and author in beautiful Tucson, Arizona. Being a small business owner is rewarding, but can feel lonely. Few people understand what it's like to sweat payroll, market themselves as a brand, or create revenue streams from scratch. For the next hour, join your tribe on Small Biz, Big Voices, the podcast that celebrates the stories and impact of your fellow small business owners. Today, we're going to visit with Steve Dunn of The Parish. Our interview will conclude with a Proust lightning round, and our final segment will be Dear Coach, when I'll coach listeners through issues they've emailed in. First, it's my pleasure to introduce Steve Dunn, co-owner and chief operating officer of Tucson's favorite southern gastropub, The Parish. At The Parish, Steve's passion for genuine hospitality is on full display. He has over 30 years of culinary experience that spans Texas, California, Louisiana, and right here in Tucson. Steve is dedicated to the local community by supporting arts, live music, and several grassroots charities. Steve, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Well, thank you, Stephanie. Great to be here.
Well, thanks. I'm curious. I want to ask you this question, but I'll tell you what kind of inspired it. Last year, I read a book called Mastering the Art of Soviet Cooking by food writer Anya von Bremsen.
And, a little light reading, yes.
Yeah, well, you know, a little bit. And actually, it's got recipes in it. It was really fascinating. She grew up in the Soviet Union before her family immigrated to Philadelphia in 1974. And so the book is this account of her childhood. So it's a very personal story, but she weaves it going back and forth between the history of the Soviet Union, kind of as it's reflected through its food, and then her personal experience with food culture in her own family. And it really reinforced for me how much food, history, economics, and memory are all interwoven together. So my curious question for you is, what kind of role did food play when you were growing up, and how do you think that food was a reflection of your family?
Well, the first thing I think about growing up with food is, I mean, it was family time.
Yeah.
We sat down, mom, dad, brother, I, breakfast, lunch, dinner, you know, or lunch when it was available, you know, with my father's home.
Yeah.
And it was just, we were expected to be at the family table and to spend time and to finish all of our vegetables.
Oh, you
and
too.
To eat what my mother cooked. But we had gardens, you know, growing up. I remember fondly asking my mother how the green beans were going to turn into baked beans or when they would. And a lot of my father was older when he had us. So, and a lot of my mom's relatives were quite older. A lot of grew up in the turn of the century, lived through the Depression. And all had gardens and all came from a farming community. So food was fresh. It was determined that eating out was an extravagance that was only for special occasions.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of my memories are of being home and with family.
My family was a lot like that. We didn't have the gardens. We had a small garden when we lived in upstate New York when I was young. But the part that I remember is always sitting together as a family, especially for dinner. I mean, breakfast, we were all trying to get out the door to school and work, and lunch, you know, we weren't always together as a family, but dinner was the time we sat down and really caught up with one another and were grilled about our day at school and how our grades were. And but that was very ritualistic. But I know that you're Irish. Were there any particular dishes that you grew up with?
Well, being from the Midwest originally, I didn't know that there was a temperature other than well done until later in life, till we moved out of the Midwest. So a lot of traditional meat and potatoes, corn,
yeah,
and fresh vegetables were well, my mother would experiment. It wouldn't be too far away from the core. Let's put it that way.
So did you find yourself eating a lot of things that your friends ate?
Absolutely. And when we moved to Texas, we moved to a border city, and I was introduced to the wonderful cuisine in Mexico, and I'm like, what is this? And my friends would make fun of me because at first it didn't make sense to me. How would you want to put something in your mouth that burned you? Until I tried it and fell absolutely in love with it and couldn't get enough of it. But I had many hard times at school with friends making fun of me for not trying anything else.
Because to them it was second nature.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think about my family and food, and half my family, my dad's half of the family, they are Jewish, Hungarian, and Lithuanian. And my mom's side of the family are French, Canadian, English, Catholics. And so food for me was kind of this delicious free-for-all. Like, there were no rules. We'd have Easter ham dinner with a side of kugel, you know, or I'd have my grandmother's beef stroganoff, which is mixing dairy and meat. Mm. And I'd be mopping up all the sauce with my grandfather's challah bread, you know. And so there were things that I ate as a kid where my friends thought it was weird. Like, I guess I was a one woman border town in that respect. Not, like, try explaining to your 9-year-old friend what matzah brei is. I mean, like, it just doesn't happen.
No.
Yeah, no. But I love how personal food is and the memories that we have of childhood that are wrapped around food. It's so social. And kind of, you know, along those lines, from a cultural point of view, what is it about the South and New Orleans in particular that inspired you and your partners to open the parish?
Well, you know, I go back to, I mean, the day in my living room with the three of us sat down and started discussing what we wanted to do. Now, I used to live and work in New Orleans. Bryce, my partner, his family's from Baton Rouge. Travis and myself and Bryce have all lived in Texas, and that's kind of our South. And obviously, we had a passion for it. Anybody that goes to New Orleans generally doesn't say, I didn't have a good time. And one thing that was very important to us is when you go out and to eat, you celebrate. You want to have a good time. It's not, it is for nourishment, but it's about the experience as well. It's about the hospitality.
Yeah.
And in business, obviously, you look for what's lacking in your community. You look for the opportunity. And obviously, there was a huge hole in this community for anything Southern or with Louisiana leanings. And culinarily, everything kind of became plural and thinking outside the box. So it was a real passion of food, being able to do what we want. We were all – Bryce had been an owner before. Mm-hmm. For Travis and I, it was our first time to actually – get to do what we wanted to do.
Yeah.
For years in this business, as you go through it and you grow and you see other people do things that you're like, oh, I had that idea, but I didn't have the capital. It wasn't the right time. Mm-hmm. And you're like, I'm getting beaten to the punch. And now it's like we get to beat somebody else to the punch. And that felt pretty gratifying.
I bet it did. Yeah. And that is, I would say that's something that is palpable in your restaurant, that when you walk in, and maybe it's because it's 2 miles from my house that I feel this way, but it really does feel like my neighborhood restaurant. It's the place I want to go. I know I'm going to enjoy every meal. I know I'm going to be made to feel very welcome. And I know that whoever is serving me that day really cares about my experience. And I mean, you really feel like you're just in someone's enormous kitchen. I love that.
You're more than welcome to jump in anytime.
You'll put me on the line. you know, along those lines, so for those listening, I have like a serious obsession with food. I love food. I mean, like, it's almost problematic. I think that really good cooking is like edible art. It's beautiful. It reaches every single one of your senses. I mean, I think it's a complete artistic experience in ways that a painting is not. But, you know, like any art form, it's very innovative. Chefs and restaurateurs like yourself around the world are always pushing the boundary of what can be done with food, the statement that it makes, or you know, causes to combat hunger, or even just coming up with edible inks. You know, it's just what can we do to be different, to be unique. And it made me wonder, you know, what are the challenges of being in an industry that attracts that level of creative freedom and risk? But as a business owner, you still have to meet kind of the more routine expectations of your clients, which themselves can be quite traditional. How do you balance all of that?
Well, I think it's conveying your message of having fun, of exploring. Everybody wants to try new things. Some people are more scared of that. Mm-hmm. But putting in an atmosphere where they feel comfortable, where they feel like they can be outside the box a little bit, is very important. You know, a lot of people put quote-unquote fancy restaurant or fancy-looking food that you're intimidated by a photograph on social media, or there's an ingredient they're not really familiar with. But if you exude that area of where they feel comfortable, where they might do something that they not normally do or try something normal to try, that helps that process along. You might look at one of our photographs and go, wow, that's over the top. That is a piece of art.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know what six of these ingredients are. But once you feel that ability to let yourself go and try those things, that's where it all begins, you know. And then you have your foodies, you have your people who seek that out. That's all they want. they don't. But I think reaching the average guest is kind of my goal of like, hey, we don't want to have chips on our shoulders. We want to be accessible. We want you to feel comfortable and try these things. They're different. We don't have items on our menu that you might see in normal restaurants. And some people don't even know the difference between Creole and Cajun cooking and they just lump it all together. And then Southern, you know, as a whole nother spinoff of that. So just making sure you're accessible to everybody.
That's interesting. I promise that I will try something that I have not tried the next time I go in, because you know I have a slight Parrish Burger fetish. And so I will branch out. That is so good, though.
I'll hold you to that.
All right. I promise I'll eat a pig ear or whatever chef is coming up with. I've seen pictures with on Facebook. You've been in the restaurant industry for over 30 years. What has changed the most in the culinary world or the restaurant world in that time? I mean, I imagine just the impact of social media alone has got to be a game changer for you.
Oh, absolutely. I think that access to ingredients, access to things that you were pretty limited in what you could get for your restaurant, even a few years ago, 10 years ago, ingredients from around the world or you know, we're landlocked in Tucson. Yeah. You know, how do you get your oysters? How do you get your seafood? How do you get, where does it come from? You know, there was a lot of, if it's not, you know, if you can't smell the ocean, you shouldn't be eating. You know, it was a lot of things years ago. Now you just have accessibility with companies and with things being shipped to you. It's great for creative processes. As far as social media, well, everybody knows it's a completely huge impact. Because everybody around the world can see what you're doing now. And plus, everybody now is a photographer or think they are with their fancy new phones. So it's just, you never know. You're always being watched. You're always being people's perception of your product is always being judged, and it's out there for everybody to see it. So you better be on your game all the time.
And they're judging it fairly or unfairly.
Fairly or unfairly. I mean, obviously they go back to still word of mouth, you know, before the internet, word of mouth was the only way of getting you still have to pay attention to that. You know, you still have to honor that people are going to talk about you no matter what. And you can only manage their perception by executing, by doing what you say you're going to do, by doing it properly.
When you talk about accessibility of ingredients, tell us just really briefly about how you acquire your annual alligator.
Well, we're talking about our Mardi Gras celebration, which
next month.
March 5th.
March 5th.
Yeah, and every year it changes with the Easter calendar. So, we get whole alligators from Louisiana. You know, no big deal. We go down there, make some friends, and get on a flight and bring it back. But we do fly in whole alligator, and we smoke them and roast them and serve whole alligator along with live crawfish that we boil. You know, we really give a flavor of the Louisiana traditions on that day.
And we tried getting in once. It was packed. You had a line from here back to New Orleans for that, for the Mardi Gras we tried to get into. So I can't recommend it highly enough. Mark your calendars, folks. March 5th.
People ask, what does alligator taste like? And I was like, well, it tastes like alligator.
Not chicken.
Not chicken. It's delicious.
You are one of three dynamic partners. And originally we talked about all three of you being on the show, but Bryce and Travis have very young families. And they couldn't be here today because they have daddy duty, which is very sweet. And they have super cute kids. So I can see why they could not tear themselves away. I think it's great that you're also supportive of each other's need for a personal life outside of what's a fairly intense business. Running a restaurant is certainly not for the faint of heart. The million-dollar question is, how do the three of you come to function as an actual team? And what advice could you give to those listening who are in partnerships and they might be struggling with that dynamic?
Well, usually two talk, one of us talks to the other one out of stabbing the other. No, I'm just kidding. No, it's having a three-headed quote-unquote monster is one of our biggest assets because we're very all strong in certain areas, and and that it's great that one of us can pick up the ball for the other one, you know, or support the other one when we're not as strong in a certain area. It makes us a very strong team. Also, you know, you have three different opinions sometimes. You know, we agreed very early, I mean, in the first hour of talking, how we're going to settle disputes, and we all agreed that it'll be a vote, you know, two against one. And I was the first loser of that put into action, and had to realize I had agreed to that. And it's tough. It is tough. You have to swallow it and say, you know, I'm going to win one of these someday. You know, because we're all very, you know, strong-willed, entrepreneurial-minded people. You know, the advice is communication. We had taken our ability to communicate to a certain level. That's when we started seeking out business coaching as a way to take it to the next step, because we didn't have the background or the skills to take our relationship. We knew that we needed help. And everybody did it freely. We all knew it. Who's holding us accountable? You know, we've always had somebody above us holding us, you know, besides the IRS and, you know, the state liquor board, you know, there was nobody really there to, so we needed somebody to push us, to give us direction and help us hold each other accountable. So in open communication, we've gotten more done, you know, speaking in our meetings with business coaching than we do in the restaurant, you know, on a day-to-day basis, because you're away from the business. You got to focus on you. You got to focus on the team. It's not easy. It's difficult. So you have to be committed to day-to-day communication and the big picture, and don't let the day-to-day tear you down. But you have to focus on everything.
And one thing I think that you three are really good at when you're working through those conversations is it's not about keeping score. I think one thing that really makes your partnership work is you really do want the best idea to win. So everyone pleads their case, but then the evidence is weighed and you regardless of whether it was your idea, you pick what you think is in the best interest of the parish and you run with it. And I think that that is, that's difficult for a lot of partnerships because you have two or more people who, like you said, they're very entrepreneurial. They're used to having a certain amount of autonomy. They're used to running their own show. And then they suddenly come together in a partnership or in a group like yours, and they have to make room in their sandbox for other ideas. And that does not always go smoothly. So big kudos to the three of you for your success in that.
Thank you. Yeah. And when you work with people who are always living in a very analytical world, and mm-hmm. then there's somebody in a very creative world, mm-hmm. you know, and then there's somebody in the middle being pulled either way sometimes. it is the growth is not in your comfort zone all the time.
Yeah.
But when you have metrics, where you do see things work, it kind of gives you a different perspective mm-hmm. of, well, it's not always my way that is right, or it's not about right or wrong. So what produces results?
Yeah. And you guys have amazing results and edible ones, which makes me very happy. We're going to take just a quick break. For those joining us, I'm Stephanie Rising, a business coach and author. And this is Small Biz Big Voices, the podcast that celebrates the stories and impact of small business owners. We're broadcasting on Tucson Business Radio X. And with me today is Steve Dunn, co-owner and COO of the Parish Southern Gastro Pub. Steve, what's a misconception about the restaurant industry that you would like people to better understand?
That we're rolling in money?
You know, that seems to be a very common misconception that ticks off more than one business owner.
Yeah.
So, like, go with that. Be as candid as you want.
Well, the average restaurant, you know, in the United States makes 5 cents on the dollar, you know?
Wow.
So 95% of your money goes out the door to run. Mm. So margins are very, very tight. You really do have to have a passion for the business. I learned at a young age, making other people happy makes me happy.
Yeah.
You know, and that makes the job a lot easier.
Yeah.
If people are going into this business for the glory or the accolades or what they see on the Top Chef or, you know, that's all great. There was a big run years ago of a lot of people going to culinary school, and shocking reality is when they got out and owed tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
And they were just cooking, sweating themselves away in a kitchen, you know. Another misconception, it's hard labor day to day, you know, mm-hmm. for little overhead. But making other people happy has always warmed my heart. It's always something that has driven me. And that includes, you know, guests as well as staff, you know, treating people with respect, treating people with dignity. Mm-hmm. In New Orleans, when I moved to New Orleans, I realized that the people in the service industry there are revered. They're very much looked up to. In some other cities and states, it's like, oh, it's just a high school job or it's something to get through college. And a lot of people have worked their way through college, mm-hmm. work in hospitality. But people that choose it as a career sometimes are looked down upon as just somebody who never really made it in life, or they're lost. And when I was in the South, when in New Orleans particularly, people that were working behind a bar or in a restaurant were very well respected. They chose it as their career and very proud of what they did. So, and that is a kind of they're just a waitress or a bartender, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those people might be running the United Nations one day. Or if they chose it as their career, you know, they put their effort into it, their best foot forward. They love what they do. You know, they care about people. So, I mean, those are a couple of misconceptions that I really have seen over the years.
And it makes me think, when George and I talk about, like, the best meals that we have ever had, it invariably was somewhere where the chef, the wait staff, the bartenders, that was their career. It was their profession. And they had very deep knowledge of food and flavors and pairings, and they were like an encyclopedia of gastronomy. And to sit down and have a meal recommended by someone with that mindset, with that level of passion, you taste it in every bite. And it's wonderful. It's such a great experience. And it also, you know, it makes me think that there are a lot of professions in this country, and I think yours included, that are almost kind of stigmatized. George went to Finland years ago, a school that he previously worked for, took their top administrators to Finland because they had the highest PISA scores in all of Europe, and they wanted to get a sense of what the schools were doing to promote education in Finland. And they discovered that after about eighth grade, like starting in ninth grade, based on a kid's natural aptitude, they were kind of either tracked toward university or they were tracked toward like vocational schools. But the difference between doing that there and doing that here is over there, there was no stigma attached to that. And if a student went to vocational school and they later wanted to go to university and further their education, they had every opportunity to do that, and vice versa. And so anyone who's in a trade or a restaurant industry or something where it's more labor-centric maybe than you know, what's considered to be an intellectual white-collar office job, over there it does not matter because your contributions are equally valued. And I found that really interesting. And after that trip and after he described what he saw, it's made me a lot more mindful of expressing my appreciation for everyone that I come in contact with and not taking for granted what their choice was or what their path was or what it is that they have to contribute, because I'd be really screwed without a lot of the professions in this town, because there's a lot of things I don't know how to do.
Right. And something I've, you know, talked to my staff about and something I've believed in for a long time is when you actually come into somewhere, you've been up the morning already. You've probably dealt with the electric company, your gas bill, the grocery store clerk.
Yeah.
And you just want to come in and have a refuge. Mm-hmm. You really want to relax. You look forward to coming in. And remember, no matter what you as a person have dealt with all day, that person's probably dealt with a lot more.
Yes.
And you need to be understanding of what is going on, that we are a refuge. We are a place of, I just want to sit and have a great meal, a cocktail, a glass of water, mm-hmm. and relax, and let me forget about what I have to deal with for the next, you know, 1 hour, an hour and a half. And to give people that comfort, mm-hmm. to you know, and feel like that they are will be able to make it through the day.
Yeah.
Even because they're choosing to come to your place for that, you know, to enjoy, to have that hospitality. So it's really important that we don't lose that humanistic view of it. You know, I never like to say customer, you know, that just puts it so negatively to me.
That's true. You always say guest.
Always guest. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And people ask me if the guest is always right. And I have said, no, the guest is not always right, but they always are the guest. Mm-hmm. Until they stopped acting like a guest.
Yeah.
and
there are boundaries.
And why I say the guest is not always right, it's like, if they might be intoxicated and want to drive, they're not right.
Yeah.
You know, things like that. So,
well, I just, it was a couple of weeks ago, a friend of mine was in town, and I took her to the parish for lunch. And she's been going through a lot of stress, shall we say, with her job. She's in D.C., you know, just a little bit of turmoil going on there. And I could see as soon as she took the first sip of her cocktail, as soon as she took the first bite of her food, just her shoulders dropped and she relaxed. And we stayed there for 2.5 hours and she was on cloud nine by the time we left. So if you're looking for a refuge, the parish is it. A couple of things, and please correct me if I'm wrong here. So Chef Travis won Tucson's 2017 Iron Chef competition. And then shortly after that, the parish won an award at an international cocktail competition in Paris with a recipe that your bartending staff invented. Tell me a little more about that.
Yeah, they're within like 30 days of each other. I think the cocktail was first and then chef. But there was a chef, Janice Wilder, was going to Paris to do a cooking demonstration. He wanted to take a cocktail that represented Tucson. And our bartender staff got together, and you can only use four ingredients. And they had to be kind of indigenous to this area. That was the whole thing. So we use Sotol, which is a quote-unquote cousin of tequila. Sotol, the plant grows in indigenous to northern Mexico, New Mexico, and Arizona. And it's been distilled by the people of Mexico for hundreds and hundreds of years. But the kind of the tequila industry has kind of kept it down because they didn't want to infringe on the sale of tequila.
Interesting.
So it just started becoming licensed distilleries in the 90s. So it's very much Southwest. So we use that as a base spirit. And we made tamarind paste out of tamarind pots. And those are our two main ingredients. And we went up against some of the best bartenders in town, and it was a People's Choice Award, and we won. So we actually had to get so tall. We had to find something that was actually going to be available in Paris. And so we found one liquor store in Paris that had the spirit. So,
okay.
So it was recreated over there. So that was really great kudos to our team. And then about 30 days later, Chef Travis won the Iron Chef competition.
Yeah, you guys, that was a glorious month for you. It's really cool.
A 1-2 punch, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, those accolades are great, you know, it's a great to reflect, and it's a part of a team, you know, it's mm-hmm. everybody, and it's a proud moment.
I'm proud of you. You guys have accomplished a lot in a pretty short period of time, relative to other people's careers. You have an extremely loyal following, and in case those listening couldn't tell, myself included. You've had all of these best of awards and so much success. What's on the horizon for the parish? What can Tucson happily expect from you next?
Well, you know, we have always talked about growth, and we have been exploring all those options for growth over the past couple of years. And hopefully soon we can be announcing some things that we cannot discuss.
I wasn't sure how much you could reveal. I leave it to your discretion.
But the future is exciting. We're this summer will be our eighth year since we opened the parish. And we're all still working owners. We all still are in the restaurants pretty much every day. Mm-hmm. You'll see one of us there. I think that has been integral to our success as well. Mm-hmm. We do have some great backup people that help us out on a daily basis. But you see owners that are absentee quite a bit in whatever industry you are. Mm-hmm. And I think you can tell the difference between somebody who's there and not there. And, mm-hmm. and then obviously the true amount of success is how will your business continue to succeed when you're there less, you know,
mm-hmm.
and putting systems in place that help maintain your quality, having the right people that maintain your spirit and your drive.
Yeah.
Is very important. And that's what we've been focused on the past couple of years.
All right. So it's a secret.
Yes.
I shall press no further, but I am going to ask you one more thing. So I'd be totally remiss if I did not ask you, what is your favorite comfort food?
Well, I was, in Ireland about 3 years ago, I got engaged to my wife, and there was two things I craved more when I was over in Ireland than anything else. And number one was pizza. And I made a very poor pizza decision in Dublin at 3 a.m, which I definitely regret. It was a wrong place to get pizza.
Oh yeah.
because I was just dying for it. And then, but when we got back after about 20 days in Ireland, we traveled for 36 hours. We flew into Phoenix, and Amy and I just wanted to get a burrito.
Yes.
And that, and I tell you, that was the best burrito I've ever had in my life. So between pizza and burritos, that's my comfort zones.
Anytime I've traveled abroad, I come home, and if I don't get a taco within about 12 hours of landing, I'm ready to flip a table. Like, I can't go that long without tacos.
Yeah. When I first moved to New Orleans, I asked where the Mexican food was, and they pointed me in the direction of what they thought Mexican food was. And it was, so I had to have people start shipping in chilies. And and then, you know, one of the benefits of Katrina was who came to help rebuild New Orleans was a lot of people from down south. Thank yeah. God.
Well, that is the end of our interview, but the beginning of our Proust lightning round. Are you ready?
Oh, let's go.
Okay. All right. So for those who are new to this, the Proust questionnaire was a parlor game popularized by the French essayist and novelist Marcel Proust. He believed that by answering 35 specific questions, an individual reveals their true nature. So we're just going to go through as many of these as we can in 3 minutes. Ready?
All right.
All right. What do you consider your greatest achievement?
I think becoming a business owner, you know, absolutely. I'm owning my own business.
If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what would it be?
Oh, Lord. Well, when I die and when I come back. Oh, rock star.
I believe that. I can see that. Where would you most like to live?
Well, my wife, which I love dearly, will say the beach. So the beach it is.
All right. We're deferring to Amy. What is your most treasured possession?
My wedding ring.
And that's a gimme.
It'd have to be my vinyl album collection.
All right. That's what I was thinking. Let's keep it 100 here, Steve.
Okay.
What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery?
I'm not working.
Really? The lowest depth of misery is not working. All right. I'm going to have to rethink my strategic plan for you this year. What is your favorite occupation?
Favorite occupation
mm-hmm.
that I've done?
If you could do anything.
Oh man, it's like, I don't know. I'm doing what I love.
Well,
I'm doing my favorite occupation.
There's nothing wrong with that. What's your most marked characteristic?
I think care and concern and respect for others.
I would agree with that. I would add twinkly Irish eyes. Definitely twinkly eyes. What do you most value in your friends?
You know, no drama.
Yeah.
I think my true friends, it shouldn't have to be difficult to have friends.
Yeah. I agree. Who are your favorite writers?
I'm a nonfiction king.
So nice.
So I like anything documentary. So I don't know if that's a favorite writer, but anything that I can learn something of other people's experiences.
Yeah. I love biographies and autobiographies. Did you read Keith Richards' autobiography?
Yes, my life.
Life. That was
I don't know
awesome.
How he remembers any of that stuff.
I was shocked at his ability to recall detail. And lastly, who are your heroes in real life?
You know, somebody asked me a long time ago, what do you think the best restaurant in town is? This is before I owned my own restaurant. And I think anybody in where do you go spend money? Where do you go hang out? That's your best restaurant. That is what you love. That's where you go. Mm-hmm. And people that's, you know, there's always going to be a new kid on the block, a new fancy something. You know, I think people that go and slug it out for 25 years and they never have maybe the accolades, but they've touched a lot of people's lives.
Yeah.
They, you know, they go into work day in and day out and they make a difference. You know, those are my heroes. Those people that really get it. They don't screw over their staff. They're nice to other people.
Yeah.
They provide a service that makes people feel wonderful and warm. I really respect those people.
That's great. Yeah. We're going to end the lightning round on that very positive note. I know I'm going to have to pick your brain for what my next 5 lunches look like.
Okay.
I should have eaten more at lunch today. I would love to have you stick around and chime in at the end of our last segment. Dear Coach gives our listeners the chance to have their emailed questions addressed. And today's Dear Coach is about what I like to call New Year's euphoria and its counterpart, goal bloat. Who doesn't love the feeling of a clean slate? It feels good to kick off the new year with goals and that sense of a fresh start. But here is my word of caution. January has only 31 days. All of 2019 has 365. So when you're thinking of what you'd like to accomplish this year, remember that it's a marathon, not a sprint. Like any marathon, to achieve your goals, you need to chunk them down into milestones. So here's what I suggest. First, figure out the destination of your race. Where is it taking you? What do you want your business to ultimately look like? Life can change so quickly. I personally think it really doesn't make any sense to imagine this much past the next 3 years. It's a little different if you're applying to a bank for financing and they want to see longer term projections. But if you're coming up with a plan that's really just for your own reference, don't torture yourself. Just think 36 months. In 36 months, what are your goals around things like revenue, profit, employees, facilities, markets? Think in terms of things that you can measure so there's a way to track your progress over time. Also, if you think in terms of what you can measure, it's going to help you create checks and balances around your decisions. So whenever you think about hiring someone or signing up for a marketing program or buying an expensive piece of equipment, you want your default mode to be automatically questioning how those decisions support your goals. Once that's clear in your mind, you're going to feel connected to where you want your business to go. So the next natural step is to think about this year. Think in terms of the outcomes that are going to give you the most bang for your buck. Years ago, I went to a workshop where the speaker used a metaphor I'll never forget. And Steve, I think I shared with you this with you at one of our meetings. He said that when you're swimming in the ocean and you slap your arm on the surface of the water as hard as you can create, you know, maybe a small, decent splash. But when the Earth's crust shifts even an inch, it can create a tsunami. And that's because all of the focus and energy is concentrated at a foundational level. So the moral of the story is avoid New Year's euphoria splashing around in surface level goals. You want to pick the few things that are going to significantly shift your business in the right direction. Then start brain dumping everything you think you need to do to make that happen. So once you've brain dumped, prioritize your actions. You may very well wind up with a long list of tasks, but don't let that freak you out and deter you. What's important is to take your time and chunk everything down into a sequence that makes sense. When you take care of one critical thing early on, often it automatically resolves 5 lesser tasks or certainly makes them significantly easier. This year, I'm going to walk my talk, and every Monday morning, I'm going to spend 15 to 20 minutes choosing which action I'm going to accomplish that week and how I'm going to do it. I find I'm a lot more effective when I'm clear about what needs to be done, who needs to be involved, how I'm going to get the action completed, and when I need it done by. Every 90 days, I'm going to celebrate with what I've achieved, and I'm going to identify my next set of priorities. I get a real sense of accomplishment from that process. And plus, I get a prize. Rewards are really important. And as business owners, we're always looking for the next problem to solve. But it's just as important to recognize what we've already achieved. So when you're putting your action plan together, write down what you're going to do for yourself when you've crossed your mini finish line. It's really amazing what you can get done when your eyes stay on the prize. If you'd like additional ideas for how to approach goal setting, I recommend the book, The 12-Week Year by Brian Moran. He is a big proponent of staying focused on shorter-term goals to avoid burnout or distraction. So, Steve, we have just a couple of minutes left. What advice or lessons could you add to that list?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. Is sometimes we get caught up in real lofty, big, huge picture goals and don't have a clear path to those. And spending time focusing on those small steps really make it attainable, really make it focused. You know, and that's what we started doing when we started doing business coaching, was breaking down and prioritizing the almost roadmap, quote unquote roadmap, mm-hmm. to that, because a lot of things got to happen,
yeah,
before you get to the place where you're ready to make that giant leap of whatever the next step is.
And it's tough when you have a lot of moving parts and they're all moving simultaneously, and figuring out the priorities to that is hard. And I can understand if people maybe tackle a couple of things that are related, you know, concurrently, but people who are like, oh yeah, I can do five things at one time, no problem. It just doesn't work that way. You can't really cross your T's and dot your I's in that fundamental way that you can then pile growth on and expect it to hold up the weight. Do you find that that's true?
Absolutely. And, you know, and then there's balance. I mean, life happens.
Yeah.
Things don't move as quickly as you want them to, or your partners want them to, but there's timing for everything. And then there is that leap of faith. There is that we've everything's not perfect, but we just got to go for it because we've done our homework.
Yes.
We know what we're getting something. We know what the risks are.
Yes.
And we're set for that leap of faith.
Yes. Progress, not perfection.
Because there is not any guarantees.
I wish there were, but there aren't. I've come close, but not 100% guarantee. That brings us to the end of today's episode. If you have a question or problem you'd like for us to talk about during our Dear Coach segment, please email me at stephanie@therisingeffect.com. You can also find today's show notes at businessradiox.com/Tucson. My thanks again to my guest, Steve Dunn of The Parish, my producer, Mark Bishop, and to you for joining us on Small Biz, Big Voices.